Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com worldwide. And I'm delighted to welcome somebody I've known for many a long year. Her name is Joan Freeman. And at least for the next couple of months, we can refer to her as Senator Joan Freeman. Mm-hmm. However, I'll get into that a little bit later. But, Joan, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Adrian. Delighted to meet you again.
The story of, you know, what was initially Pieta House, then Sullis, and now another name change after 12 years. Is there another name change?
No.
It's still
Sullis. Sullis House, yeah.
Sullis House. Indeed, very close to when you organized Pieta House in Ireland. We had a chat in Ireland, and it would have appeared at that time that this was a massive undertaking, and there would be many who would doubt indeed that it would you know, that it would take off, so mm-hmm. to speak, because it was, it seemed like a mammoth job. Many felt at the time that this is something obviously that the government of Ireland should be taking care of, and then that wasn't too difficult to understand, because at the same time over here we found that you know, the whole topic of suicide was so taboo. We were able to talk about everything else. We were able to talk about alcoholism, drug addiction. We were able to talk about abortion. We were able to talk about same-sex marriage. However, speaking of suicide was something that sent shudders through us. In Ireland at that time, and don't know how much it has improved since, but it is a topic that is extremely disturbing, and to most people simply don't want to even think about it, much less address it.
And to a certain degree, there is still that reluctance in Ireland. It's not just Ireland. There's reluctance to admit that someone in your family has been suffering so much that they thought that the only option was to die. But what has changed in Ireland is that this service, which is known in Ireland as Pieta House, has changed the social fabric. It has given permission for people to talk about it openly and not be afraid to seek help. So many days, if you went into Pieta House, you would see a room full of in the waiting room, a room full of people waiting to be seen, and they all know why they are there, why each person is there. And you will see children in school uniforms who are coming to Pieta House because they are self-harming or are in crisis, and there's such a wonderful openness about the subject, and it doesn't normalize it. We are not normalizing suicide. Yeah. What we're trying to normalize is the ability to talk about it.
Let me just ask you, though, about that period of time when you decided that this could no longer be ignored. And you know, some at the time might say, the cheek of this one, this is something that we always grade, of course, at sharing the blame and shoving it off. But wait a minute, this is a job for a government, this is a job for health service, this is a job, you know, that requires massive funding. This Joan Freeman is just taking the bull by the horns herself and tackling something that, as we say, just going back to my initial remarks with respect to, you know, talking about it openly. That must have been a fairly lonely road at that time.
it was the loneliest road ever. I remember approaching a well-known sports person who had just gone into media communications, asking him would he help us in some way with a bit of his expertise, and he absolutely categorically refused because of the topic. So it was a lonely road. Yet, on the other side of the coin, the moment the public became aware that there was going to be something for people, that it was free of charge, that it was rooted in compassion,
yeah,
that it was then people started supporting us. And you said there, Adrian, about why isn't the government... You know, if research would tell you that things that start at grassroots level, not at government level, has a far better result in achieving what they want to achieve.
As we know, yeah.
I mean, even if you think of other charities in Ireland, like Vincent de Paul,
right.
Where would we be without Vincent de Paul, who helped thousands and thousands of people every year who are the new poor? So it's far better to start off at grassroots level. The other second very lonely road was coming over here to New York.
Mm-hmm.
That was the hardest possible journey ever.
And you know where we say, where would we be here? And I think New York is a perfect example. Where would we be without the organizations that take care of the Irish? You can obviously the New York Irish Center, Emerald Isle Immigration mm-hmm. Center, mm-hmm. Ashling Irish Center. When they started off and when they got off the ground, it was a reaction to a crisis. We had, at that period of time, a great number of people who were coming over the enforcement of our ludicrous immigration laws was kicking in. People were now not at all sure that just in a few previous years, you were here undocumented, but nobody was going to bother you. The organizations that are here and many others, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, and I'll get into trouble because I won't have be able to list off the other 99, but the organizations that were started at that period of time also had mammoth a job to do and helping out in so many other areas. However, when it came to mental health crisis, and that's what we're talking about, the referral system took an awful lot of time to even get a proper referral system. And again, I let's not mix apples with oranges, but I can tell you that undocumented here, being referred to some of the mental health services here was a very, very shaky position, because many of them, because of their undocumented status, mm-hmm. could not at all feel comfortable, about even being referred, much less, following through on that, mm-hmm. on that referral. Can you talk about the early days of your getting started, and where did you start?
Do you mean in Ireland?
Yeah.
So, as in most charities in Ireland, they're started usually because of a personal experience in a particular area, and my experience was no different from a family bereavement of a family member, which, you'd love to think that you had this noble thought to save the world,
mm-hmm.
but the reality isn't like that. Sometimes we're motivated out of guilt that we haven't helped people when they needed it. So that's really where this organization started from a place of, driven probably by guilt, but also for need to bring change to those who are suffering.
But you're already a therapist. You already had experience. You already knew the topic, and now added to that, you've had, you know, the horrific experience, the tragic experience of somebody in the family. How, again, I know you're saying you approached some people who perhaps were, you know, in similar circumstances, had a family member or a close friend. And how did you get that first office open? What was, and at that point, were there people who said, okay, you go ahead and we'll support you?
No, it wasn't like that. There was one person, all right, and I'll speak about him. But, I mean, it started off with the thought of the Pieta, that beautiful sculpture.
Yes.
I've spoken about it before, which just inspired that sort of light bulb moment where you think what we need in this country is like the Pieta, that sculpture where Mary's holding the dead, broken body of her son. We need someone to embrace the broken lives of people in our community. So it started with that thought. The next thought followed very quickly was, I need to get a house.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew a person who would be interested in helping. So we spotted a house, went and registered a company, made it a charity. We spotted a house, he paid the deposit and paid the mortgage for the first 3 years. But in the meantime, for me to open the doors, I needed to borrow money.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody going to give me one penny because they would have thought I was insane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you said, we didn't talk about suicide. So why would anybody want to give money? So I borrowed 130,000, and when you're talking about 13 years ago, that was a fair bit of money. And
huge amount.
The bank would only give it to me if I gave my home as collateral. So the real hero is my husband, Pat, who didn't bat an eye. We had four teenage children at the time. We had a mortgage house. And he didn't bat an eye. He said, go ahead.
Did you, at that time and for those first few years, how significant was it, or did you feel that the service you were now providing, which again, it didn't exist, and if it did, it was a very small scale throughout Ireland, more of a family kind of support system, but did you feel that a massive amount of money would need to be put in the till to start this off? How did that work?
Do you know, again, I would be every accountant or every board member's nightmare because I never thought of strategy or budget or where the next few bob is coming from.
Mm.
If we needed more staff, I would take on more staff. So we were, it was demand led rather than having any intelligence about having a strategy. So I never thought about money, ever. And it's funny, every time we helped people, I mean, for example, here in New York now this evening, there's a fundraiser going on from someone who we helped in the last couple of years,
mm-hmm.
who felt that this, you know, he wanted to give back.
Yeah.
And that's how it works in Ireland. And it's the same sort of policy here where people just want to give back.
You would need that. I just wanted to talk about the progression and the impact that Pieta House, which we now on our side refer to as Solace, is still Pieta House? Is it Solace? Is it...
So in Ireland, it's Pieta House. The reason, there were lots of reasons we had to change it to Solace House, simply because, you know, 80% of Irish people are Christian or Catholics.
Yes.
They would understand the Pieta. Whereas in New York, we have so many religions, so many different nationalities. So we wanted a name that people would understand instantly, without an explanation. And Solace means to console and give comfort. And so that's why we called it Solace House. Also, it had to be a separate entity from Ireland, because if anything happened over here, Ireland, the organisation Ireland, could be wiped out. So we had to make it a separate entity.
The success of Solace in New York is indeed, it is contagious, and it is being held as a model for several areas of the United States. And again, I think it would be good to point out that going back to your own grassroots movement, when you opened in New York, in the New York Irish Center in Long Island City, there were a lot of people who felt at the time that this is great, but how is this going to work? How are people going to come forward? What about the confidentiality? To some degree, if we talk about other areas like Alcoholics Anonymous or you know, in many of the drug addiction places, there's still kind of area of personal reluctance. You don't go marching in or waving a flag. God Almighty, how are you going to, in New York City, in some places prominent as the New York Irish Center, how are you going to do your outreach? How are you going to get that word out?
Mm. So, again, like back in Ireland, you need a referral pathway. You need to connect with other organizations or agencies who will refer people who are in crisis. But also, word of mouth is another very powerful thing. But one of the things we've discovered, that we will be found out anyway, is because we've discovered that we are serving the people of this city who are either undocumented or just cannot afford health insurance. They are just above the poverty line, only maybe in some cases by $500 or $1,000 a year. So they will hear about us and have heard about us, and they're exactly the people who are coming to us, and we're so thrilled that we can do that for people of this city.
I suppose one of the overbearing questions from the beginning is, we can all relate to suicide. How do we identify what leads to suicide? How do we how do we identify, but before somebody gets to Solace, before that referral comes in, can you help us understand I guess there is no boilerplate reference to, you know, what leads to self-harm and suicide, because self-harm is a pathway. There are a lot of those who are actually in self-harm that perhaps don't have are not thinking of suicide, but it gradually, or is that correct to begin with?
So there's two questions you've asked me there. So the first one you said about the boilerplate. There actually is a template almost that you can identify what we call the tipping points that may cause someone all of a sudden to go into a state of mind where they feel that ending their life is the only option. one of the things is that people keep thinking that those who take their lives have mental health issues. Mm. So we have found the complete opposite. Suicide usually happens to those who are reacting to a life event. So when you say the boilerplate, so take a man.
Mm.
The man's tipping points are, number one, if there's anything to do with his work, whether he's been made redundant, he's retired, he's unemployed, his business has failed, because with men, their identity usually comes through what they work at. And if that is impaired or damaged in any way, their sense of security and their own confidence is suddenly shattered. The second tipping point for men is the ending of a significant relationship. So, for example, if either their partner dies or the relationship is over, those are the two tipping points almost always that will send a man over the top. So just in relation to self-harm, we also would look at self-harm in a very different light. The majority of people, you know, who would self-harm would be under 18-year-olds. And the reason behind it is because they don't have the vocabulary, or they are unable to articulate their emotional distress. So their body becomes like a blank canvas. So sometimes for them, hurting themselves is easier to deal with, the physical part of that, than the inner turmoil. So we would always say, if a child self-harms, there's nothing wrong with the child. In so many ways, there's nothing wrong. It's just they cannot describe their distress.
For the teenagers, for those, for that category of people, is there an awareness, say, with parents in the household, how much of that is can be attributed to perhaps dysfunctional families, domestic abuse? Is that easier to identify than, say, a family where everything seems to be just great, thank you, and a member of that family might have suicidal tendency or self-harm tendencies based on other aspects, maybe can't keep up with the expectations? Are there too many of those to pick the top two or three?
So I've always said that the family members are the last people to know that there's someone in their family that's in distress. Because if you think about it, you're out of the home maybe 8 hours a day, whether you're a child or an adult, 8 to 12 hours a day. You come home, you don't particularly want to talk to anybody, you want to sit down, have a cup of tea, do your own thing, and just chill out. Now, that person could be withdrawing, or that person could be just chilling out. The family do not know. But the person who might know is the person who works with that person all day long or sits next to them at a school desk. They're the ones who will know and who will be able to measure the mood of that of their colleague or their fellow student. But there are a couple of issues that's facing young people that didn't affect us when we were growing up. And of course, the first one is social media, which has, especially with the bullying aspect, where when we were children, the bullying could stop at 4 o'clock in the day, but the bullying here on social media continues all night. Children have far more difficulties to face now than we ever did, even things like the breakup of a relationship, parental relationship. But I think one of the, probably the most important things we need to look at in families today is that if you think about, you know, a family, say there's two children in the family, and when everybody comes home, they're almost living in separate apartments. The child will have their own TV, maybe.
Right.
They'll be on Facebook, they'll be up in their room doing whatever it is that they want to do, and people don't even have dinner together. So that even that one meal a day is a moment when parents can check in on their children and see what's going on for them, and just to have that conversation, even if the conversation is that the child's given out about the food.
Right.
You can gauge in some way how your children are doing.
Yeah.
So it's about bringing back maybe one or two things of the old days.
Yeah, but I reflect as you're saying that about you know, the comparison between today and when I was a child, where communication with parents was not great. You know, little people should be seen, not heard. Mm. And there were many distractions rules at that point that were not helped by Mother Church, in the sense that there was, not only could you not talk about the subject, but there were terrific, horrific, in hindsight, ramifications with respect to, again, through the influence primarily of the church and the
state.
Schools and the state, that if you were even to think about that, it would be hell and damnation. Mm. You could not be buried in consecrated ground. You would have done, generations of harm to your family. And so if you take that to then, to forward it to today, I can very well, you know, relate to what you're saying. That also had its problems.
Absolutely.
Back then. But today, you're competing with
the world. Mm. And, you know, I agree with you 100% about the shackles of the church and of the state. And it's only, you know, at my age that I'm realizing how completely we were controlled. When you're at my age, you realize that you put up with it and thought this was normal. But I can say in defense of when I was growing up, nothing to do with church and state, but there was a structure to a child's life. There was breakfast, dinner and tea.
Right.
There was the rosary at the end of the day. There was a communication, not of the communication that you were thinking of where you were seen and not told not to speak, but there was even the reading of the faces of your children.
Yes.
And I think that type of structure, to some degree, if it could only be brought back, not necessarily the rosary or anything like that.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is maybe that meal once a day, maybe that few hours on a weekend where you turn off all phones and everything else and you just reconnect with each other.
Kind of a tall order, but it's
doable.
It's doable.
It's definitely doable.
Let's move to the next bracket. You have teenagers, you have those who are perhaps having great difficulty in relating to life and the changes. On self-harm, which sometimes leads to either attempted suicide or suicide, at what point is there a level of complacency with respect to, well, thank God that period is over anyway? Is there such an identification?
First of all, people think that self-harm is a suicide attempt, and it's not. For young people, it is a coping mechanism. It's a coping tool. And the reality is we all self-harm to some degree. We either, as adults, we either eat too much or drink too much.
Right.
We stay in risky relationships.
I'm glad you didn't bring up cigarettes. But
that too. We don't look after ourselves. We don't exercise. So all these are sort of long-term impact. Whereas the self-harm that you're talking about is acute and immediate. But you've got to keep thinking of the very basic and simple explanation for it. And that is, if you had a very, very sore toe, and it was really sore, and it was occupying all your thoughts, and then later on that day, you caught your thumb in the car door, your focus of attention would be on the thumb that was caught in the car door, not your toe. And that is what the simple explanation of self-harm, sometimes it's a way of distracting. It's distracting from that inner pain. It also, for some children and some adults, is a way of relieving pent-up emotions. So it has its function. And if you were to tell a child never to self-harm again, you're taking away their only coping tool. So what we do here at Solace House is we teach them how to verbalize their distress and slowly move away from self-harm. It's one of the most successful things, and it happens very quickly.
You mentioned, of course, that outside of the family, which may, you know, not be aware of an impending crisis, Solace House and your model has, in fact, had an impact with Department of Education, with U.S. military, also looking at what you're doing. What kind of pressure does that put on those who you have entrusted with being responsible, the therapist? What kind of pressure does that put on you, your organization, and in particular the therapist?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've discovered one thing, that nothing, no model should be rigid. And it took me a couple of years to realize that sometimes a therapeutic model needs to be tweaked because of the culture that it's in. But also the biggest thing that I discovered is that there's 8.5 million people in New York. There is absolutely no way that we have a place here in Queens and one opening in September in Yonkers that are we able to cope with the 8.5 million people. So we said, what other way can we do this? So the best solution of all is, say, for example, the military. They already have existing therapists.
Right.
Go in and train them. Train them the Solace way. And therefore, we're helping all those people without them having to travel to us. The same with schools. There's already existing counselors in schools. Train them up the Solace way.
Are you welcome? How do you knock on that door and say, by the way, this is what we do. This is, this is our track record. We think that actually we can help you. How does that?
They actually come knocking on our door. We don't go knocking to them.
I knew the answer. I wanted
Did
to hear
you?
It out
yeah.
loud.
Yeah. It's sense. Funny, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
And it's remarkable also. Here we are, a little Irish group here in the biggest city, and an extraordinary city. And sometimes I arrive into New York and I feel so small. And yet we have been approached by the Department of Education. The Chancellor heard us at one of our presentations and wanted us to come and meet. The same with the military. We know there's massive issues with the soldiers who have with post-traumatic stress disorder. But, we can't be everything to everybody. So therefore, what's the next best step? And the thing is to empower existing therapists.
If we were just to look at the breakdown, say in New York, where you have here, you had mentioned, of course, the stresses for the male, and the men who have in particular. Those who have responsibility either or who feel that the responsibility is theirs, yet the figures show that females are most likely, there are more females.
So just on, first of all, we wouldn't, even though I've mentioned the tipping points with men, we would never, ever expect them to take responsibility for themselves. And believe it or not, we ran a campaign in Ireland called Mind Our Men.
That's,
And what we were asking were the women of Ireland, including little girls and bigger girls, to mind their husbands, mind their sons, mind their brothers, mind their daddies. And that's because when you're going through a crisis, sometimes you're not aware of how deep that crisis is. But someone else might if they know the signs. You also mentioned women. So the tipping points for women in particular are around, believe it or not, the highest rate of female suicide in Ireland, and I would expect the same here. I know that the highest rate of male suicide is around the age 45 to 55 here in white male in America. But so women were looking at anything between 45 and 60 years of age. And again, if you just use the simplicity of that statement, why would that? Why would women be affected at that age? And just think, there's a series of losses that women have to go through between the ages of 45 and 60. Not just physical, they become menopausal, they lose their fertility, their children might leave home. They probably don't feel attractive anymore. And then sometimes the relationship breaks down at that point and they see their ex-partner forming a new family and a new relationship. And that can be hard for a woman. So if we're aware of all the tipping points, whether it's male or female, that gives us as a community, whether the community is in New York or in Dublin, to reach out to those people that we know are going through those difficult times in their life.
We also, as we, recognize, with amazement that that your organization, the organization you founded, has managed somehow to provide a service for those who can't afford it, those who don't have insurance. I'm sure many people are wondering, well, why don't I just write a check now and support this organization? On many other areas, people might, in fact, feel, well, I tell you what, we will pitch in, we will, we will volunteer, we will do something, but obviously on this one, this is such a an organization that what can we do? Volunteer? Is there a support group that has been born in Sullis House here in New York? How do people react to that?
Do you mean like a support group for providing the service in the city?
Yeah.
Not really. And I suppose what we're doing is what's very so typical of the Irish, that we go to the Irish over here, the poor, unfortunate Irish people who are continuously begged for support. And
belted,
they have been
every which,
They've been extraordinary. That's why we've survived. But at the same time, we go from hand to mouth every month. And that's very typical of new charities. And we have a charity number and we have all that. But what we could do with, of course, is the equivalent to a very rich Irish farmer. Do you have any of those over here? The equivalent of the Irish rich farmer?
If we are, we're not going to tell you about it. I just want to ask you, though, about the therapy. The therapists. These are not just volunteers people who
absolutely
come in off the street. It's a very specialized area. And to secure a therapist who, in fact, is proficient in this particular area, that can't be an easy job either.
No, it's not. And also, you've got to remember that in New York, attempted suicide would be regarded as a medical problem.
Right.
So So people would go to the emergency room, they'd be put into lockdown, all that sort of thing. So while we would have lots of therapists who would have that type of experience, they wouldn't have the experience of the solace way. So whenever we take on a new therapist, they are trained in the solace way, that they see that compassion is the first thing that the client would experience when they come to the center.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
the most important thing is about confidentiality. The second most important thing is that they are listened to, that they're basically, that they basically realize that they're not the only ones that have gone through a period in their life like this. And I suppose the biggest question of all is when a client comes in here for the first time, the therapist will ask the question, why do you want to die?
Mm-hmm.
And followed by a question, why do you want to live? And so probably for the first time in a long time, the client will walk away thinking about living.
Yes. And they're not questions that will be asked
normally.
You know, normally.
Yeah.
A great place to start. I know that solace is well known in the New York area. But still, we do see, as I've mentioned earlier, that, you know, right across Irish groups throughout the United States, the word has gotten out. It's gotten out there as well, because this is a very unique, significant, specialized area. For those in New York, or for those who want to reach out, those who want to know more about solace, about the work you do, let's get first of all, let's give you the website, which is Solace House, that's SolaceHouse, Inc. It's SolaceHouseInc.com. I want to give a telephone number too, which is 718-482-0001. Confidentiality is the key, and it is there. Now, what I do want to ask you is treatment free? Does this depend on whether somebody has insurance or not insurance? Does it make a difference whether those who you treat or those who are coming forward, whether they're documented, undocumented, whether they have a job, whether, you know, any of those areas? I'm sure these are questions that all of us want to ask.
Yeah.
And ironically, in a topic as sensitive as this particular one, is where's the catch? Is there a catch? The fear that we all have in terms of saying, well, something this available, this good, can't be free.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny you should say that. It's only since I came to America I've heard that doubt. There must be a catch. But just to reassure you about a couple of things. First of all, you said about do we have a group of people that's supporting us. The most important group of all is our board. These are Irish and American people. Pat McGowan is the chairperson, followed by Paul O'Brien, who only became involved if we opened this service out to all of New York, not just to the Irish. So that was the first thing. It's free of charge. You don't need insurance. Even if you had insurance, we wouldn't be claiming it. Remember, this is about people. We happen to be serving the people who don't have insurance, but it doesn't matter whether people do or not. And the other thing is, this isn't just for the Irish. In fact, most of the people who are coming, at least 60%, 50 to 55% of people coming to us, are not Irish.
And then you wonder why we might say, where is the catch? Our record here with respect to undocumented with Irish, with the confidentiality, with the horrific anti-immigrant attitude, which we don't have to spell out, gets worse by the day. There are a lot of doubts. There are a great number of people, you know, who may say, well, okay, so where do I start? How do I know? How do I make that first call? And that's a huge onus to place on somebody who already has very severe,
issues. Yeah. Issues. So, and you're so right again. And the thing is, the onus isn't on that person, because they wouldn't be able for that next step. So the onus is on the person who's beside them. And I keep referring back always to this. If you broke your leg, nobody would expect you to go and pick up the phone and get an ambulance yourself and make your way down to the hospital. So why would you do that when someone is emotionally broken? And that is the way to be thinking of it.
Give us a structure. Give us a starting point. If you know of somebody, or if there's somebody, or correct me if I'm wrong here, but if somebody is in such deep depression, it's got to be noticed by somebody. If not in the family, you mentioned at work, it might be in the neighborhood bar, it might be in some kind of social setting. How does the sponsor, let's say, approach? Does that have to go to the person? Does the person, how would say somebody be of help other than saying, by the way, here, why don't you go over to Solace? They're over in New York Irish Center. So can you give us just a bit of a...
So you're absolutely right again. So if I saw you limping, I probably would say to you, Adrian, I see you're limping. You seem to be in pain. And if you said, it's all right, and I'd say to you, I know a doctor, or I know a place, they're absolutely extraordinary, and they can help you. Will I make an appointment for you? And I'll go with you. Do you see how simple it is when you say that?
There is the key.
Yeah, that's the key.
You don't, again, you cannot, we can't expect somebody who is in that thing. You don't just tell them, well, here, go.
Yeah.
It's great. I want to let our listeners know that Solace is indeed, it's a separate organization. However, they are housed in New York City, in Long Island City. New York Irish Center website is newyorkirishcenter.org, and we did a couple of weeks ago. We had Paul Finnegan, who is the director of the New York Irish Center. You're going to expand into Yonkers in the next few months, and we'll stay in tune with that.
Brilliant.
And the telephone number, let me give you a telephone number. It's 718-482-0001. The website is Solace House Inc., solacehouseinc.com. And we will list the organization attached to our website as well, irishradio.com. I am so delighted, and like most people, are in awe of the success, first of all in Ireland, and that there seems that your aspirations know no bounds when you take it across the Atlantic. And when, for something that you don't see any banners waving or flags or whatever, that an organization as effective as that can save so many lives and bring some kind of resolve to those, not just to those who are affected by this, but to those who are beside themselves in wondering how they can help somebody. Again, it's terrific.
Well, can I just say, Adrian, that, you know, it's easy to bring an organization to a country when you have a team that is so brilliant and so inspiring, as such as I have here. And in fact, just to give you a bit of groundbreaking news, there's a young woman here who invited Piesa at the time to New York several years ago, and she is going to be the new CEO of Solace House starting tomorrow, and that's Rebecca Sked.
Well, congratulations to Rebecca too. Again, friends, you can get information from that. My guest is Senator Joan Freeman, and I made some reference earlier, you know, in the program to something that could worry us. Now, bad enough, you know, that you have your hands full. You're a senator in the Oireachtas, the government of Ireland, and obviously you have, you know, a lot on your plate. Do you really want to become president of Ireland? Come on now. Enough is enough. First of all, congratulations.
I'm not even a quarter there. Yes.
I know that. But you didn't just think of this yourself, because, you know, one of the best publicized secrets around Ireland was the one, even when it looked like there wasn't going to be any, you know, competition for the presidency, and, you know, other rumors were around, yeah, Sinn Féin is probably going to select a candidate and so forth, but I'm not too sure when you found out that, yes, it would be, that running for president might be a good idea, but a lot of others had felt for a long time that yes, you would be a perfect candidate. Now, we're not going to lose you from all of your other endeavors here, because this is a hell of a time now for you to cut out. you will you know, lead the organization, which has been such a rip-roaring success.
So I will remember that Solace House is always cursing and coursing through my blood, through my heart. I can never, ever abandon it. I will be on the board, but I will be leaving the development of it to Rebecca Sked and the team. I've done here in New York what I did in Ireland. I scraped the ground and I dropped a few seeds, and it grew with the help of a gardener who watered it and fed it and made it develop. And that's what I've done here in New York. So essentially my work really is completed from that point of view. However, I'm going to be on the board. I'm going to be watching with the BDI, Rebecca Sked,
right,
and to see that she will never lose the ethos of this organization, which I don't think she will for a moment. As far as the presidency is concerned, I always think that anybody who says that they're going for presidency, that they must have an ego the size of Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
So let me reassure you why I'm going for it. I'm going for it to put the most enormous spotlight on mental health in Ireland. And by doing so, it's also going to put the spotlight on mental health in New York. And I think that is the way we can make changes. We can't, the president cannot change policy. But I remember Mary Robinson, who was a former president.
Indeed.
I remember once she said that her lasting memory of being a president was the fresh smell of paint wherever she went. Because people would want to do the place up, make things right because the president was coming. And that is exactly what a president can do.
Joan, at worst, we will welcome you back as senator. And, you know, and then, you know, being a journalist, absolutely, it would be totally and absolutely inappropriate and out of the question for my to do anything other than wish you the very best of luck.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
Okay,
thank
John
you.
Freeman and friends, just again, I want to give you the website, which is Solace House Inc., SOLACE House Inc.com. The telephone number 718-482-0001. And Solace House is a separate entity, but it is housed at the New York Irish Center in Long Island City in Queens. And you can always reach out you know, to us. We'll give you the information as well. You're listening to The Flannelly Show, Irish Radio Network USA, and irishradio.com worldwide.